Today at Reader's Corner, Noah Eisenberg, author of We'll Always Have Casablanca, The Life, Legend, and Afterlife of Hollywood's Most Beloved Movie. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the release of Casablanca, perhaps the most beloved of all Hollywood films. Somehow, this love story set in wartime seems as relevant today as when it first lit up the silver screen back in 1942. People who've never even seen the movie still recognize its famous lines, and references to Casablanca abound in novels, plays, musicals, and other productions. In a new book titled We'll Always Have Casablanca, Noah Eisenberg delves into the film's fascinating history and considers why it has remained a revered part of our cultural landscape. No one anticipated Casablanca would have such lasting impact. But a cast of immigrants and iconic actors, including Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, worked magic with a screenplay adapted from an unproduced play written by two unknowns. Casablanca went on to win Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay, and has enjoyed more revival screenings than any film in history. Noah Eisenberg is Director of Screen Studies and Professor of Culture and Media at the New School in New York City. He is the author of several previous books, including Edgar G. Ulmer, A Filmmaker at the Margins, which was selected as the best film book of 2014 by the Huffington Post. Dr. Eisenberg joins us today by phone. Noah Eisenberg, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's terrific being here.
So, Noah, I have to kick off with a question here about the Academy Awards. I see Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay. Were Ingrid and Humphrey nominated as well for their roles?
No. They were skipped over. Claude Rains got a nomination for Best Supporting Actor, and he got that nomination many, many times over. But no, Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, surprisingly enough, especially for the diehard fans like us, no, they didn't. They didn't make the cut in the end.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned in the intro that this seems as relevant today as it was then, and I'm thinking of that opening when you see this map of Europe and North Africa, and you see this streaming line of refugees fleeing Europe, running down across the Mediterranean to Casablanca, and then, of course, over to Lisbon and into America. It's a different direction they may be coming from these days, but there certainly are some parallels here, aren't there?
Yeah. It's as if things have been flipped a bit, in that we have refugees now, well, especially from Syria, no doubt, but even from parts of Northern Africa who are making their way or trying to make their way to Europe. It's amazing, I think, when you consider that refugee trail as it's spelled out in the map insert of the film, and how these languishing Europeans were trying, in many instances, trying in vain to secure exit visas in that film, and how we have these refugees today who are similarly languishing and hoping and praying to make their way into Greece in many instances, into Europe, and again here the lucky ones will find a home maybe in Sweden or Germany. Those are the two European nations that have taken on the biggest burden of resettling refugees, especially from the Syrian crisis. I do want to correct myself moments ago, though. I was concerned because I when you're talking about the Oscars, and I was listening to myself say, oh, yes, we have Claude Rains. That is indeed correct. But Bogey did get a nomination. He didn't win is the thing.
Oh, okay.
Bergman got skipped over altogether. So I wanted to correct the record there because I had to take a quick peek and see where things stand.
Sure.
But, yes, getting back to the refugees, I think that this is one of the reasons that the film continues to resonate. You said in your opening there, Bob, you mentioned how the film lines of it, for instance, are taken up in musicals, in novels, in all manner of pop culture. That's certainly true. But today, when we watch the film and we are thinking of people who are trying to flee war torn homelands, it's hard for the film not to strike a certain prescient or powerful note in the contemporary register. And what I mean by that more concretely is, I'll give you just a quick anecdote. When I was interviewing the Swedish critic, a fellow named Morten Blomqvist, who writes for one of the leading dailies in Stockholm, Dagens Nyheter, he tells me how he was in Cannes in 2015, and he was there covering the film festival in France, and there's a Swedish picture. It's a documentary of Ingrid Bergman. So he's being interviewed just to talk specifically about that documentary, Ingrid Bergman in her own words. Then he's asked about Casablanca. And in 2015, as a Swede here in the Cannes Film Festival, he watches the movie again and he realizes, he says in this interview on the radio, he says, oh my God, for the first time he recognizes not just this bittersweet romance between Bergman and Bogey, but this is really a refugee picture. And I think that because of the current backdrop of this refugee crisis, and I'm thinking specifically of Syria, but also elsewhere in the world where you have refugees from war-torn regions in South America, refugees from war-torn regions in the Middle East, in Africa, elsewhere, this, I think, keeps the timeliness of the film very much alive. And in 2017, when people, for the 75th anniversary, when they go back and watch the film, as you yourself just did, I think it's very hard for us to overlook that aspect. That's highlighted for us right there in that folksy newsreel voiceover by Lou Marcel, that kind of March of Time style newsreel voiceover, when he announces that, that all of Europe has its eyes on the Americas and that you have these refugees who are, in fact, waiting and waiting and waiting.
So for our listeners who may have watched Casablanca way too long ago, or perhaps for some who have never even seen it, why don't you give us just a 30-second thumbnail sketch of the plot, and then we can go from there.
Oh, sure. The plot concerns a very hard-boiled, cynical saloon keeper who's in a North African outpost running a cafe. What we learn as it unfolds, however, is that he once had a terrific affair, a wonderful romance with a Norwegian woman, both of them in Paris on the eve of the Nazis marching in. What we learn, though, from the film as things continue to unfold is that this saloon keeper based in North Africa, in Casablanca, may not be quite as cynical as he gives us to believe. And from there, everything from the underground movement and the figure of Victor Laszlo and all of the wonderfully deep, deep supporting cast, contribute to these different thickets of the story and the side plots and the accents and the minor tales that we are introduced to in one of Hollywood's best crafted and most beloved of all movies.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Noah Eisenberg, author of We'll Always Have Casablanca, The Life, Legend, and Afterlife of Hollywood's Most Beloved Movie. So do you think that Bogart, who transitions from this somewhat cynical, self-centered guy into this guy who feels he has a larger mission in life, is somewhat symbolic of the American people about that time regarding the way they were looking at the war and whether America should be there or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think one could answer with a pretty emphatic yes to that question. I think that Bogart is, so if we follow his character arc, so to speak, if we follow that move from being what seems to be a principled isolationist, right? I stick my neck out for nobody. And even if it turns out that those principles may be just as half-hearted, as Louis Renault, as Claude Rains's principles, as his half-hearted embrace of Vichy. What it does, though, is as we follow Bogart's development, as we follow Rick Blaine's development and his return to the fight, and it is a return, is that there he recognizes his true beliefs, his true moral compass, so to speak, just as the way that Madeleine LeBeau, who plays Yvonne, comes back to her senses again politically once more, comes back to her senses when she stands up to sing that very impassioned rendition of the Marseillaise late in the film after she returns to Rick's Cafe on the arm of a Nazi officer just a scene or two before that. So I think that you see a lot of these transformations. We're made privy in this movie to little bits and pieces little precious facets of Rick's past. We know that he ran guns to Ethiopia. We know that he fought on the side of the loyalists in Spain. That, for any savvy viewer or people like us, Bob, who've watched the movie, I don't know about in your case, but I'm deep into the triple digits. these kinds of facets, these little pieces of information, should tip us off and let us know that Rick actually may not be quite as principled of an isolationist as he professes to be. But no doubt, I think that the character arc and the kind of the political trajectory of the film, moving from isolationism and cynicism, that hardened shell of Rick's that needs to be penetrated ultimately, and it's penetrated, I think, when from the moment that Ilsa, that Ingrid Bergman returns onto the scene, and Rick essentially falls apart, to the moment that Rick decides to help out that Bulgarian refugee couple, Anina and Jan Brandl, played by Joy Page and Helmut Dantina, by helping them to win at the roulette table. And we know, of course, in Rick's Cafe that, as Carl, the waiter, tells us that it's things are as honest as the day is long, right? No one's cheating there. Least of all, Louis Renault, Claude Rains' character, who collects his earnings before blowing his whistle and making that another line that's quoted over and over again in newspaper columns, in novels and so forth. I'm shocked to find that gambling's going on in here.
Right.
But yes, I think that we do see the sort of the character arc as well as the political trajectory of the film follow similar lines. If we were to plot it on a kind of a graph, that America too was following from the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And it's the day after that important event that the unproduced stage play, Everybody Comes to Rick's, arrives in Burbank, California, and that Hal Wallace and his, his contract writers begin to vet that and to make that decision to make Casablanca in the summer of 1942. And so it's all against that backdrop. It's against the backdrop of America immersing itself, becoming more deeply committed, more deeply involved in the Second World War. And when it's rushed into release, when the premiere takes place here in New York City on Thanksgiving Day of 1942 at the Hollywood Theater in Midtown Manhattan, that's done because the Allies had just landed on the beaches of North Africa just 2 weeks before, and General Patton's troops were victorious there. And so Jack Warner had a production together with Hal B. Wallace. It's a signature production of his, the film Casablanca. He had just done Now Voyager a year before, the first in his series of signature films for Warners. But they both felt that this was an opportunity they just simply couldn't pass up. So the film is very much nestled, you might say, in actual historical and political events that were unfolding across the globe.
So this was a 1940s Hollywood production movie. It was all shot, I believe, in Warner Brothers Studios in California. Was there anybody that thought this was going to be a classic?
That's a great question. And, it requires a little bit of conjecture on our part and looking through all of the studio memoranda as I did and all of the other, testimonials to see whether anybody really felt that way. And that one I would answer with an emphatic no. Yeah. I don't think there was anyone, certainly among the sort of the chief players in it all on both sides of the camera, who thought that this was going to be, the film that is best remembered, the film that is most beloved. And to rack up the awards that it did a year and a half later at the Oscars ceremony. And I say a year and a half because technically it was a 43 release, so it took a while for it. It wasn't included in the slate of pictures that were reviewed in the 43 ceremony, but rather in the 44 for those films that were, again, part of the 1943 cycle. So I don't think anyone could have possibly dreamed of its success. Michael Curtiz, the director, this is 60-something film. He was known for his efficiency, known for his ability to bring things in by the deadline, or even a bit under not only under the deadline, but also under budget. There's a great quote from Julius Epstein, one of the Academy Award-winning screenwriters who helped to adapt Everybody Comes to Rick's for the unproduced stage play. He and his brother Philip and Howard Koch, the three of them, would earn an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. He remarked, he says, "We weren't making art. We were making a living." And I think that that's the way it was thought of for a lot of people. I mean, these are the great days of the studio system, and this was more or less assembly line work that they were doing. But quite famously, Bogart and Bergman both had severe doubts about whether that this was a right film for either of them. Paul Henreid was worried about being, and I think it turns out, at least in retrospect, rightfully worried that he was going to be upstaged by Bogart. He considered himself to be a leading man, and he had already been, just a year before, in Now Voyager, that other signature production by Hal B. Wallace, he had been cast as a romantic lead. And in this film, suddenly, Bogart is occupying a position that Bogart himself had never occupied prior to Now, and that is as a romantic lead. He was very worried about that. He didn't know whether he could pull it off. His agent, Sam Jaffe, felt that he had what it takes, but Bogart was concerned. He was concerned about the height differential between him and Bergman. He's wearing platform shoes in the flashback when he's dancing with Bergman, cheek to cheek to Perfidia. Bogart's in platform shoes. He was worried about that. He also didn't know how to dance. He just didn't know if he had what it took. He claimed famously late in life that he didn't do anything any different in this picture than he'd done in the previous 3-4 dozen pictures that he'd been in. But in this case, Ingrid Bergman looked at him with that amorous gaze, and poof, suddenly he was a romantic lead. And as for Bergman, she, you know, was constantly confused, didn't know whether she was going to, you know, she needs to know who's the man she's going to board that plane with. Even though much of that information was not only pretty clear in the screenplay, even as it was being written and rewritten, and also clear in the unproduced stage play, Bergman was constantly told by Michael Curtiz and Hal Wallace, but Curtiz specifically, with his very thick Hungarian accented English, said, "Don't worry, play it in between, play it in between." And so she had to play it in between, and to express that this kind of, again, ambiguity, this uncertainty, is she going to express her final love for Victor Laszlo, so for Paul Henreid, or for Rick Blaine, for Humphrey Bogart? And a lot of that comes across beautifully in the film. And you know, whether that was purely, as Andrew Saris, the late great critic, once remarked, the happiest of happy accidents, or whether this was something that was more planned, it's hard for us to say.
So tell us how George Raft and Ronald Reagan don't figure into the movie Casablanca.
Yeah. There's a good question. If, you know, for fans, people love to speculate about this one as well. So a press release was sent out in January of 1942. And in that release, it was announced that Reagan and Ann Sheridan, who'd just been in a picture together in King's Row just a few months before and was still in wide release at the time of this press release. I think what Warners wanted more than anything else was to get boldface names. I think this was a PR attempt to draw further attention to them and to their other picture that was already out. There was never really any real intention, I think, of casting either of these two figures. And as for George Raft, who's also mentioned in a separate release, it was Jack Warner who felt that in their studio memoranda to this effect, that he felt that George Raft would be a great Rick Blaine. Hal Wallace, however, who really, again, this is a signature film of his, a film that's got his name in you know, bold type of the credit sequence. This is a Hal B. Wallace production. He said it was always a film that he intended to use Bogey for, and he even claimed that the film was being written for Bogart, which is maybe a little bit of overstatement. But neither George Raft nor Ronald Reagan nor even Ann Sheridan were ever really seriously considered for the picture.
That's an amazing part of the story. The cast is also an amazing part of the story in that here is a movie about refugees, but when you look over that cast, tell us who they were.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's you know, this is something Pauline Kael, who was a great film critic who wrote for many, many years for The New Yorker and elsewhere, she didn't have much kind to say about this movie. She thought of it mostly as a kind of, her word was a schlocky romanticism. And yet when it came to the refugee players who were cast to play these secondary roles, many instances secondary roles, some of them mere day players, you know, came, said a line or two, and that was it. She said this is what really bestowed upon the film a kind of authenticity, something that made it far more believable and made it more poignant than it ever would have been had we had a number of American-born actors faking these French, Italian, German, Austrian, Hungarian accents. And so you have that deep cast of supporting players, many of whom had fled the Nazis. If we take one of my favorite anecdotes, if we take the not yet 20-year-old Madeleine LeBeau, I mentioned her before, she gives that impassioned rendition of the Marseillaise and real tears are streaming down her cheeks. She and her husband, Marcel Dalio, who plays the croupier, who plays at Rick's roulette table, plays Emil, they themselves had fled Paris just on the eve of the Nazis marching into Paris. They made their way to Marseille from Lisbon on a Portuguese freighter and ultimately to Hollywood. They'd experienced that. They'd experienced what was being portrayed on screen, and they certainly weren't alone. Among those day players, when we first brought into Rick's Cafe, we hear a woman say, she's just trying to sell her diamonds. She says, but can't you make it just a little more? Well, that's the German stage actress Lotte Palfi, who was also somebody who had gone through the rise of National Socialism. There she was in Hollywood. She was merely a day player, as the expression went. But still, she manages to again convey that authentic experience. These weren't just actors playing parts they had to learn by way of method acting, but rather these were people who had gone through this. Many of them had gone through this experience themselves, and even those who were a bit more removed, such as the director, Michael Curtiz, he had family stranded in Hungary during the making of this film and was deeply, deeply torn emotionally. There was extraordinary fear, anxiety, turmoil that was sort of swirling around stages 7 and 8 in Burbank, California, at Warner Brothers that summer. So many of the people on this production, Curtiz, I just mentioned, Essie Sakal, who plays Carl, the jowly waiter, they still had family who was stranded in Europe, and they were very, very concerned. And while making this film that deals with refugees, they themselves, I think, brought to it a kind of experience that otherwise would have been lacking and that wouldn't have given the film the kind of texture and the kind of richness that it has just by the nature of their very presence. In some cases, it's their accent. In some cases, it's a gesture. In some cases, it may be something entirely unspoken, just a glance, a look. And this sounds overly abstract, but I think if you go back and you watch the film and you watch as the camera, Art Edison's beautiful cinematography, as he takes us into Rick's Cafe, and you hear these snatches of conversation, and you hear these many of the conversations in foreign tongues that are untranslated in Mandarin, in German, and so forth. I think you get a sense of the complexity and of that texture, of that richness that they brought to the film.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm interviewing Noah Eisenberg about his book, We'll Always Have Casablanca. The book looks at the history of this iconic film, which was released 75 years ago. I've often heard people watch old movies and come away criticizing how elementary they were and how they just didn't get it compared to what we have on the screen today in 2017. As you And since you said triple digits, I think you're the foremost expert on on Casablanca. No question about that. How do you rank and rate it compared to what's on the screen today? Does it stand up? I mean, I know it stands up as a classic. I know it stands up as a movie people yeah. love to watch. But I'm talking about you got into the technical effects there.
I did just a bit. I mean, look, it doesn't move at the same pace. And I think that's not necessarily a criticism. Uh-huh. If anything, it may actually put another star in Casablanca's right. column there. The pacing is deliberate. I was saying about Michael Curtiz that he was known for his efficiency, and the film definitely moved, but nowhere near at the speed of a lot of contemporary productions. That said, and this is for me something that has been really gratifying and a real pleasure to watch as I've, well, first while writing the book, but now as I've been going around the country and doing a few different book events in bookstores and at theaters, often where there's a screening involved as well, and doing sort of a post-screening conversation, is to see how well the film plays for audiences that have never even seen it. And I mean across the generational divide as well. I mean for teenagers, even younger. My 11-year-old sat with me late. I'd been laboring on this book for a good year or two, and he'd heard me talking about it nonstop, and he finally decided he wanted to watch it with me. me, and he watched it. You know, he's used to the Bourne franchise and to
right.
and to other films that move at that sort of lightning speed. And he watched it with me, and he was immediately swept away, which was so. And I wasn't expecting it.
Sure.
And I kind of pressed him, and I said, "Really, you enjoyed this? You sure you enjoyed it?" No, and he liked it. He liked the moral clarity for him was important too, to see, especially in Bogey, to see him do the right thing, to see this movement towards helping others. And also, look, let's face it, there are no better screen demons than Nazis. And Konrad Veidt is another great dark irony of history, who himself had fled the Nazi regime. He was married to a Hungarian-born theater actress named Lili Prager, who was Jewish. And he fled soon after the stunning ascent to power of Hitler in January of 1933. But even Konrad Veidt, he brings this sense of a sinister and an ominous character of National Socialism that's immediately recognizable, immediately identifiable for even an 11-year-old. And I think that again, too, helps to make the film stand up. Watching it today, when I go and do, you know, introduce the film and do sort of post-screening conversations, I always ask, and this is something that Monica Henry, Paul Henry's daughter, does too. She's done a number of these, and I kind of took the tip from her. She always asks, how many people have seen the movie before? And in many instances, it can be upwards of 50%, maybe more than 50% of the audience. But then watching it and hearing them laugh, seeing people also get a bit misty-eyed or choked up during the singing of the Marseillaise, all of this is amazing to see. The film continues to play consistently and to elicit an ardent response, not only among those diehards like us, but also among the first-time, you know, initiates. And what's funny, of course, for a lot of people, especially the younger set when they watch it, is they become suddenly aware of how many lines they knew from the film simply from reading about it, right. Seeing cartoons and whatever in the New Yorker magazine, and watching The Simpsons, six episodes or so of The Simpsons, that draw on the film and so forth. There's SNL, Saturday Night Live spoof that was done with Kate McKinnon and
Woody Allen.
And Simmons.
The list goes on.
Play it again, and with Woody Allen. So yes, it goes on and on.
So I'm going to read these off quickly. Here's Looking at You, Kid. Kiss me as if it were the last time. It's the same old story, a fight for love and glory. Of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the world, she walks into mine. We'll always have Paris. The problems of three people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And that's the end of the movie. Tell us about those lines. Where do they come from? How many were bogeys? Did he make them up? How many were the Epstein brothers?
Well, the last one you ended with, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. That's Hal Wallace's line.
Oh, okay.
And it's funny. I teach a screwball comedy course, and we get into the more recent romantic and screwball comedies. And so my students were just watching the Nora Ephron, Rob Reiner collaboration on When Harry Met Sally. And it's Billy Crystal's Harry who says, "That's the best line ever. Best line ever in a movie." It's a split screen scene. Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal watching in bed. You know, again, this is these broadcasts, a film that's been aired on television more than any other picture.
Right.
And there they are watching Gossip Block, and Billy Crystal say, "You know, the best line in a movie ever." So that's Hal Wallace's line. A lot of the cracks that are delivered by both Bogart and Claude Rains, the wise cracks, the witty ones, are attributable in most instances to the Epsteins. Round Up the Usual Suspects has got a great story to it. The Epstein brothers were looking for a way to, you know, transition and a way to kind of wrap up an otherwise relatively messy scene. They're driving down a windy patch of Sunset Boulevard. They get to the intersection of Beverly Glen, and these twins, they turn to each other, and apparently, so the story goes, without any prompting, say, "Round up the usual suspects." And so that's how they arrived at that.
Right.
And they were known to finish each other's sentences, and they were again known for their very dry, I like to call it martini dry wit. Bogey is credited with having come up with the line, "Here's looking at you, kid." That apparently is a line that he liked to use off screen as well. And whether this was improv or whether they wrote it in, I'm not entirely certain. I wish I could tell you that with 100% certainty, but it's often attributed to Bogey. Another line that is attributed to him is the "of all the gin joints in all the world, in all the towns in all the world," blah, blah, blah. Poor Howard Koch, he doesn't get credited with many lines. Koch is often credited with the more political aspects of the script, but not the famous lines. I mean, I mentioned moments ago that he ran guns to Ethiopia and fought on the side of the loyalists in Spain. It's thought that Howard Koch probably airdropped those little bits of information into the script.
Well, Noah, I've really enjoyed interviewing you and had a heck of a good time reading the book. And again, the great thing about your book is that it causes the reader to go back and watch Casablanca. And that's what everybody ought to do, is buy Noah Eisenberg's book. It's called "We'll Always Have Casablanca, The Life, Legend, and Afterlife of Hollywood's Most Beloved Movie." Noah Eisenberg, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful treat speaking with you, Bob. Thanks a lot for the interview. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. Next week, Charles Fountain, author of The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series, and The Birth of Modern Baseball. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.